Non. Quite common observation that however happily situated, however happily we are situated, there is something that frequently visits us to spoil our happiness. Despair. Despair is loss of hope. Disappointment comes, and who is not free from anxiety? And there is some sort of fear of many things, fear of loss, and actually we may suffer loss, pain. This constantly visits us, it haunts us. This is the reality of life. Can we deny this? Now, let us step out of the small circle of personal self and look at the broad picture of the life of the world, or the life of our fellow men, millions and millions of them. So, if we regard human life in general, beyond our small circle of personal lives, what do we see? Great majority of common people suffer from deprivation, having deprived of opportunities, deprived of human dignity, deprived of basic necessities of life, exploitation of millions by those who have the means and the power for their own benefit and increase. Do we see poverty everywhere? Do we see millions of heart-rending, innocent children, women, and innocent people being victims of war, of genocide, of revolutions? Don't you see millions suffering in natural calamities? Now, let's ask this question. Can we be happy when there is so much of suffering in the world? Consider again violence against women, violence against children, their exploitation and their subjugation, pedophilia, their curse on humanity. Can we be happy when all this is going on right before our eyes? Now let's ask ourselves. Okay, I am ensconced in a very happy life. All that is not going to touch me. I have no connection with it. Can we say that? Have we not had a hand in causing these awful miseries of life? We have no hand in doing it. What do we know? Will it not touch us at some time or the other? If not in this life, in some other life? Now, this is a question that we must bestow our thought. Okay, if you say riches and luxuries are the source of happiness, are the wealthy, the well-to-do, really happy? Material possessions, influence, power, they enjoy. Everything seems to be at their command. But none of them is free from the same fear, anxiety, and and fear of loss. And finally, death is going to snatch away all that. As Red in the Path says, I don't have a book with me. Buddha asks, right from the childhood, the youth, adolescence, and all through the stages, we experience much anxiety, much disappointment. No, despite all this, undeniable facts of life, don't we recognize that just we have to consider this? Can we have only happiness and avoid sorrow? Can we have only pain, pleasure and avoid pain? Now, what is necessary for us to understand is that we live in a world of relativity. As the last sentence in the first fundamental proposition says, universe is pervaded by duality. In a moral sense, in the world of human life, it is the dvandva, the pairs of opposites, of light and darkness, happiness and sorrow, pain and pleasure. So, don't you understand that happiness is good? I mean, we all enjoy it. But don't you recognize that happiness is only one aspect of life and the opposite cannot be avoided? In spite of all this, that happiness, sorrow, pleasure, pain, disease, sorrow, they're all concomitants of life. And yet, there is so much promise. There are so many opportunities, so much joy in life. Only if you look at the bright side of life. The pessimist is one who always looks at the dark side of life and bemoans. An optimist always looks at the bright side of life and he moves forward. Now let's ask this question. Where does happiness or sorrow come from? Where does happiness come from? Do happiness come from objects, things we possess, the gadgets that we have? Do they come from our relationship with our fellow men or kitchen kin? It seems to be that happiness or sorrow, happiness come from gadgets, objects, things, relationships and so on. But actually, if you think about it a little in depth, you find it is not so at all. It is not the objects and things and the relationship that gives us happiness, whatever it may be. It may be positive relationship, negative relationship, whatever it is. The source of happiness is not in relationships or things and objects. The source of our happiness and unhappiness is in our attitude towards it. There is the secret of happiness, attitude towards life. And your happiness is a state of mind. Heaven is not out there in beyond the clouds. Happiness is a state of mind. Hell is not underground, under the ground. Hell is a state of mind. Vishnu Purana speaks of 28 hells and says only by way of example. He enumerates them. And it says that these hells are not in time and space, but they are negative state of mind. So where does sorrow and misery rest? It is our attitude, your state of mind. It is our attitude towards life, our outlook on life, our state of mind. In this is a key to happiness. It is shaped by our knowledge of what is life. Now, having said that right attitude is the key to life, how do you get this right attitude? Going along in the usual careless way of life, resting on mere sensation, happiness related to pleasure and happiness related to the objects. We will never find any answer to these questions. That will be wrong. We'll not get the right attitude at all. Right attitude comes from knowledge of what life is, who we are, whence we come, became, whither are we going, what is the purpose of life? Do we ever ask these questions? And if you discuss these questions in a social circle, you will think that there is something wrong with you. They will avoid you. No, there are two perspectives. One is the perspective of the I at the end. Other is the perspective of the eye of the eagle, mountain eagle. In the first case, the eye of the ant, crawling on earth. What is its range of perception? Probably a few square feet. Our personal existence, as the Dhammapada says, personal life, is the ant eye perspective. How much of the landscape that the ant can see? And it interprets the whole world in terms of a small area of experience. Similarly, our personal life is a very constricted, small, dark perspective. And in terms of the personal self criterion, we interpret the whole world as whatever is good to personal happiness, whatever is good for personal self is happiness and so on. But in this eagle eye perspective of the personal self, you will never find answer and you will never find happiness. As the Dhammapada teaches. Now, coming to the other perspective of the eye of the eagle, Now, eagle, flying highly above the mountains and the plains, sees a vast landscape and sees everything in its correct perspective and is not deluded. The judgment is always right. The correct perspective. And it's only a metaphor. So eagle eye perspective would mean just in the terms, the soul perspective. So in that higher perspective, like the eagle surveys the whole landscape, we survey the whole of life and see in them, in everything, in every event, meaning and purpose. So, this is a very important idea that you must bear in mind, is one of the greatest mitigating factors of sorrow in life and makes life bright. This is soul perspective. Now, how do we develop the right attitude? There are two simple truths you must bear in mind. Of course, to develop the right attitude, we must step out of this ant-eye perspective of narrow, constrained, ignorant personal self. Step out and learn the simple truths. You don't have to go out to universities to learn the simple truths. You don't have to go to any school to learn the simple truths. They are there right before us. We see these truths every day in our life experiences, and yet see not. So these simple truths of the science of life, simple truth of the science of soul. If we learn this and apply in life, in every direction, then we will learn a very important lesson. Then we will learn that happiness is not true happiness is not dependent upon objects, is not dependent upon persons, is not dependent upon conditions. True happiness transcends all these relativities of pleasure and pain, happiness and sorrow, of all changeful things. You find happiness deep within you, will you become aware of, will you contemplate and apply these basic truths of life, you begin to see that source of true happiness, which is not happiness in the ordinary sense, but a joy. So in that joy, no matter what transpires in personal life, you discern a nobler purpose, a deeper meaning, a profound understanding of every event. So let's consider the simple truths. Couple of them. One, this is something which no one can deny, that he cannot find this simple truth in his own life, around him, in him, his own personal existence. It is not a simple fact, undeniable simple fact, that life is pervaded by duality, dwandva, pleasure and pain, light and darkness, happiness and sorrow, hunger and satiety. So, this cannot be avoided. Now, if we know this, if we know this well and understand this well and admit it, much of our unhappiness gets mitigated, though the unpleasantness or pain that may come, we suffer from it. But we will have a certain balance and stability, and we discern a greater purpose than this changeful things. That's why watch of the silence is accept the woes of birth. When you are born, this dvandva is attached to you. You cannot avoid it. Is it possible to avoid it? So accept the woes of birth. That's why the Bhagavad Gita, the very first lesson, Krishna teaches we used to rise above this world form. It's something that we know in life, we experience it every day. So Krishna says in the second chapter, for the wise man whom this disturbs not, and to whom pain and pleasure are the same, is fitted for the mountain. So this is the thing that if we understand and admit and look upon life in this life, how much of unhappiness is mitigated? It is not. And then second important law of life, which no one can deny. We may turn a blind eye to it, but that's our fault. And that is impermanence of personal existence. Impermanence of everything that exists. There is an incessant, unceasing change. You know, the eternal doctrine of eternal change of atoms, which just speaks of in his teachings. The third fundamental proposition. Nothing remains the same for one fraction of a moment. It becomes something else in a progressive order. Things, relations, conditions. Now we wish to preserve them and keep them unchanged. It will be foolishness. We cannot. So if we understand the basic truism that everything is subject to change, it is unceasing change, then it is not accepting it and not clinging on to things and trying to preserve as they are, and inevitable change that snatches it away from us brings pain. But if we admit this truth, then when change occurs, you will not be thrown off your balance. So you see a purpose in it, a deeper purpose in it. Now, we have seen how loving couple deeply attached to each other. When one goes, the other is terribly cast down and devastated emotionally. Why? They never contemplated this truism of life, that everything is subject to change and one or the other have to go only, and it's a progressive order. Going or leaving this world is not the end. It is a progressive march to higher and higher accomplishments. When we know this, when we admit this, so much of otherwise sorrow, which is conformity of the anti-perspective and I-perspective, is mitigated. Now, Bhagavad Gita says in the 13th chapter, when we speak of all this, people don't like it, but unfortunately. And yet Krishna says in the 13th chapter, the meditation upon birth, death, sickness, error, is a discipline that one has to practice in life among many of the virtues that he lists. No, we are souls. We are not biological creatures. Wife is a gift to the husband. Husband is a gift to the wife. Their souls, they have come together for a purpose. Children are loaned to parents. We cannot say my wife, my husband. We cannot have possessive attitude towards them. Their souls. Their souls, they have a long past. They have a long future. It is only a temporary we are shared together. So let's understand what the purpose is. And let's try to fulfill in our short life the purpose. So it is like throat sand and jet sand, dry sticks and debris flowing in the river or on the sea. due to, you know, the flow of the current sometimes come together, they stay together, and when the direction of the current changes, they get apart. Like that, we, you know, families, you know, friend circle, you know, come together for a while and then depart. You cannot hold them on forever. And that wrong attitude of holding them forever and grieving when inevitable change comes, it comes from a wrong attitude. And there's another very important but not so well-known little recondite truism. And much unhappiness that comes from that. Unhappiness not only in present life, this unhappiness we carry forward to future. Two circumstances arising out of our relationship with our fellow men and our attitude towards it. The chief source of trouble in not knowing this and acting in accordance with knowledge, the long-term effect in bringing and continuing life after life unhappy situation. But little is known about this cause. When we know this truism in its true life, then we will know how to resolve it, how we can turn the negative aspect causing pain to positive aspect of making for happiness. So what we are speaking of is the mysterious power of sympathy and activity. Mr. Judge speaks of it in the letters that are healthy. In our life, very common. Sympathy, which bonds the family members together. Antipathy, which brings about strained relationships and enmities. Sympathy with a certain group and certain practices and so on, and dislike for other practices, other circumstances. So, sympathy and antipathy, like and dislike. The Bhagavad Gita Krishna warns, a wise man should not fall into these two passions. And yet, we are every day, every hour, moved by these two passions. And then, look for happiness. Can happiness ever come? Now let's try to understand this with some illustrations. Now, we meet some people in life and instantly we somehow dislike, right? We don't have liking for this person. They're a stranger. But within the family, there are certain members of the family whom we dislike. And the other person also may dislike us. So this is antipathy. And you ask a modern psychologist, behavioral psychologist, he will give you some foolish, wrong reason for it. He says, oh, something must have happened in your early years, so this is what happened. You don't know, because they don't admit soul life. They don't admit that man is a soul having a long past beyond before birth and a long future in eternity after death of the body. So if this antipathic magnetism that we experience with some is due to the cause that we generated in a prior life, which we are carrying forward now. We separated in the prior life. And this very antipathy brings us together. Because we have produced karma, and the moment we come in contact, this old antipathy asserts itself and dislike happens. And we give in to it. And then we shun. And what has happened in that case? This antipathy attitude deepens. And the person with whom you have antipathic tendency develops a reaction which in lives to come will be coming in the way of your happiness. She will become, you know, whether knowingly or unknowingly, that person will be a cause of obstruction in your life. That is the cause of your unhappiness. Similarly, sympathy. A mere sympathy without the attachment, without the higher perspective, also can be unhappiness. So we have to remember that we are souls. Your sympathetic relationship is due to the past sympathetic relationship, and this has to be raised from the personal to higher sympathetic, higher purpose, higher perspective. Transmute the merely emotional sympathy to higher sympathy and broaden it to include all others. See, this is something we can practice, and this makes for happiness of life. Now, the important thing is, if this antipathetic attitude that we experience, have towards others is not overcome, then it becomes a source of great trouble for us life after life. It generates conflict, discord, and source of unhappiness. So that's why Judge says in the letters that he's talking to a student. The student complains that he's very unhappy. Now Judge points out, your unhappiness, do you think it is due to the action of another person whom you think has caused your unhappiness? He says, have you had any of you had unkind or revengeful feelings to him? If so, ought you not at once drive them out of your heart? For I swear to you on my life that if you have been troubled or unfortunate, it is by the reaction from such or similar thoughts about others. Drive them out of your heart and present such kindness and brotherliness to him that he shall, by the force of your living kindness, be drawn to full unity and cooperation. This is the key to happiness. Now, we know what the aphorisms of karma is. The sway of the karmic tendency lasts for at least 3 lives if measures are not taken to counter them. How do we counter them? 3 things it mentioned. Suppression of tendency, elimination of defect, setting up counteracting actions. Now, when we have a person whom we dislike and he mutually dislike, and we consider the poor and all that, if we know this truth of life, then what we will do is we will suppress this tendency and try to eliminate the defect of character of not liking and disliking. How do we do that? By setting a contracting cause. That is, deliberately, purposely, get up in us a loving kindness towards him. In thought, word, and deed also, do good to him. Get that higher thought that he is a soul, a personal existence which we see in him is only a passing phase. He is eternal, like you are eternal. In the eternal, you are one. So these higher thoughts, you set up contracting causes of charity, loving kindness, loving deeds. Now, what have you done by this? You have curtailed the sway of the karmic tendency of the past and mitigated it to a great extent. And in the next life, you are sure to come across the same character, in some other relation, some relationship with the other. And the old mutual antagonism asserts itself. But your past exercise of charitable attitude also is a mitigating factor which enters into it and dilutes that animosity. And out of the force of psychic return of impressions, you continue this. And finally, what happens, the previous antipathies is entirely eliminated and you strike a harmonious relationship with one with whom you had antipathic relationship and convert them into, transmute them into one of friendship, cooperation, and this is what makes for happiness. Charity. Charitable attitude. Charity is not giving money. It's charitable attitude. Charitable attitude means that when harm comes to us from any source, we must know that the hand that smites me is my own, not any other. If anyone is doing me harm, unconsciously or deliberately or otherwise, it is the harm I have done to myself by my own wrong action. And the person who is doing me harm, apparently doing the harm, is only instrumented in it. This thought will give me a charitable attitude to him. I will not revenge, but I will understand the cause of it and set about removing the cause, as the karma accordingly says, charity. So when enmity comes to us from past negative relationship, we must take it as an opportunity. Recognizing that it has a long past by your wrong attitude, now is an opportunity to step right by suppression of tendency, elimination of defect, setting up for contracting cause. So your enemy becomes your friend. Your antagonistic person who was antagonistic to you will become your helper and will be in various ways helping you. This is so we have, you know, Red in the Path speaks of the great mystery of life. Your friends are a great mystery. Your fellow human beings are a great mystery. Your enemy is a still greater mystery. And our masters say that you owe a great debt of gratitude and duty towards your enemy. So is an opportunity. So this you must practice in individual lives. Individual lives. Now look at the communal hatred that is being bred in India. Do you think it is going to do good to India? It is going to snowball into a calamity, unspeakable calamity. Because people do not know this. In the Deccan Herald, there is an article, whether Prasanna draws my attention to it. Today, people are drawing from the well of poison. Our ideas about life, our ideas about ourselves, it is absolutely enveloped in utter darkness. And another very important source of unhappiness to us. And which, if countered and transmuted, can be a source of happiness, key to happiness. And that is criticism of others, sitting in judgment over others. There cannot be worse hypocrisy and evil than that. Criticism of others. Now, there's not much time to build deep upon it. When we criticize others, there's an assumption in us that what defect we are presenting in him, his deed or whatever, we are free from it. Don't be anxious. What defect that we see and sit in judgment over is a projection of our own weakness and our own shortcoming. So, never, this is the meaning of what judge, what Jesus says, judge not others, lest you be judged. And much can be said about it, I think, because the shortage of time is, we stop at that. So that's why judge says, when occasion arises to criticize, what he says is, that, what he says is, am I the judge in this matter who is entitled to try this person? Second, am I any better in my way? Do I or do I not offend in some way, some other way, just as much as they do in this? No, this settles the matter. There ought to be no judgment, no criticism. If some offend, then let them ask what is to be done. But only when the offense is against the whole of community, whole of mankind, a whole of an institution like UIP, then we have to do something. But if the offense is against ourselves personally, against us, then let it go, forget it. Forget and forgive. So this thought by some to be goody-goody, but I tell you, the heart, the soul and the bubbles of compassion are of more consequence than intellectuality. This is the judge's wise counsel. Now, look what judge says in letters. All our troubles in life arise from ourselves. We are fools in pointing fingers at others for our troubles. This is ant eye perspective. In the eagle eye perspective, this we recognize. All our troubles in life arise from ourselves. No matter how much they may seem to come from outside. We are all part of one great whole. And if you try to center your mind upon that fact and to remember that those things that seem to trouble you are really due to your own way of looking at the world and life, you will probably grow more contented in mind. It is your own mind you should watch and not the circumstances in which you are placed. This is the eagle eye perspective. And gratitude, forgiveness and gratitude. That is the source of true happiness. Now, gratitude to life, for what we have. Gratitude to our friends, our parents, our relations. All who helped us to make what we are, to unseen people in the great wide world, unseen people, every one of them has contributed to my well-being, to nature, the peasant, the trader, the laborer, the capitalist, everyone has contributed to my well-being. What do I do in return? To nature, to sun, the moon, the soil, the water, the fire, the air, plants, those kingdoms of nature which make up my tabernacle, to my teachers who have given this divine wisdom, gratitude. And feeling gratitude is not enough. So, it means fulfillment of the obligation of doing in return what you have received freely from others. So this gratitude and a deep sense of obligation to return the good that we have received from the people whom we know nearby and to all the life outside us, all our fellow men, to our teachers. How do we fulfill our gratitude to our teachers, obligation to our teachers? Study the great knowledge they have given us. Get up in us the conviction of universal brotherhood and the true realization. So we could become true helpers of humanity, develop the right attitude and right purpose in life. And as the SD study, we read that important direction, we ought to become helpers in the divine evolution of ideas by becoming to the best of our abilities co-workers with nature. If misfortune befalls us, we must be grateful for that. If you are struck with disease, you must be grateful that it is curable and passing phase and something harmoniously adjusting the previous wrong, previous discard. And if death comes, I must be happy that death is not the end. Life and death, what we call life and death, is life itself. And if death comes, be grateful, then more life. And the Holiness Dalai Lama was once asked by journalists, look, your brother died very recently, you never went to see him. He said, what is there to see him? Yes. Pick the body and take up another body. What is there in it? Is it not the same thing as what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita? That thou grievest for those that may not be lamented, whilst the sentiments are those of the letters, the expounders of the letters of law. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself was not thou nor all the princes of the earth. Nor shall we ever hear the cease to be. The Lord of this mortal frame experiences then in ancient seasons and old age, so in future incarnation will it be the same. One who is confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that takes us apart. This is wisdom in action. This is the key to true happiness, which is not dependent upon relationships, not dependent upon things, not dependent upon objects. A happiness that is inherent in us, joy, the light of joy. So lastly, live to benefit mankind. That should be our goal in life. Live to benefit mankind. Live to benefit mankind. And it said, act for them today. They will act for me tomorrow. Every help physically, morally, and spiritually that you render is a help that you offer. Any help that you give to others is never lost. You have, as Sarvajna says, Kattittiruva the Putti Sarvajna. What you give is a treasure that you have already created for your future use. Act for them today, they will act for you tomorrow. And finally, I end with a passage from Judge's article, The True Kiosk is Part. Remember this, that as you live your life each day with an uplifted purpose, an unselfish desire, each and every event will bear for you a deep significance and offers meaning. And as you learn the Nimpo, so do you fit yourself for higher work. Higher work. So let's conclude here, friends. We have a couple of minutes. There may not be any questions because, I don't know, there may not be any questions. We have deliberating thoughts were exchanged, shared. I think there is much to think about it. So let's remaining time meditate on some of the points proper. And meanwhile, if anyone has a comment to make or question to ask, that's also open. Thank you.